just decided now to call this talk Recognizing Empowerment and I think it's so valuable or so lovely to be able to recognize when something is happening in our practice that is planting us or grounding us back inside a very clear view and back inside a very trustable view, a trustable reference point. And I think when those moments happen, when we're seeing something very clearly or our wisdom, our own wisdom is rising up, that when that's there to recognize it and to feel the brightness of that and the life of those moments. And in other traditions, practices are set up or initiations are set up to offer an empowerment. A teacher through a particular practice will offer a student an empowerment. And I think that these are really helpful. But I also feel when we have those moments deep inside our own intimate practice, when that rising up happens, it is so beautiful to notice. And so I'm going to speak about one of my own, because it was a noticeable moment. And it happened to be when I was at Dhammaloka. So I was at the place in the mountains where Jemma and Jaya invite people to come and practice and people can do their retreats, and it's up in the mountains. And every day, or not every day, but very often I would walk to where the spring is, like through this track to where there's a spring and all the blackberry bushes. And in that area there is a big rock. And sometimes there was a big rock like down below in the valley, and then up above there was like a big mountain ledge, and I used to sit up the top of that and just, you know, ponder and potter. And I used to always feel whenever I entered that valley, I thought, I'm going to have this practice of just, in this moment, profoundly trusting, like profoundly letting go and not holding back. I made that my secret place of experimenting with this. And I was sitting there feeling this feeling of just really releasing. And I was sitting like, I noticed that I was kind of slightly crooked. I was slightly bent, like I was kind of like this, just in that moment. And then suddenly something happened that I can't remember what the words were. But I turned my body and I noticed that, and I sat up and I noticed there was this big, almost like a rocky throne chair that I didn't realize that was just behind me, like I was all crooked. And then I sat up on this rocky chair and it even like supported both of my arms, and like I rested back into it, and it was like, whoa. And a lot was obviously happening inside that I'm not sure I'm expressing outwardly, but I was really sitting a little bit hunched, and then I just went whoa and sat back in this big chair, and it was a moment of this is actually how I can sit. In it, there is actually so much more space for me to occupy even in this moment. And actually the feeling in the chair, there was such a royal feeling of fullness that it was quite ecstatic. It was like, whoa, it doesn't need to be crooked. Like I can actually sit up and take this seat. And there is something in this feeling of allowing our bodies just to fully open and receive a moment, and how much can happen in a retreat like this when we're just coming to lie down and to sit, that we're also not engaging in habitual movements of our bodies that we might go into as we keep coming to lie down or we keep coming to sit. The actual posture provides a kind of container for whatever's happening inside to move through with a little bit more ease. So the actual form of our body, the the length of our spine and our openness plants us in a kind of depth that allows life to move through. So sometimes when we have a feeling, there's such a, as we all know, like our minds and our bodies are really connected. So a certain energy will come in of pain or any kind of feeling. And as we can keep open around it, non-collapsing into that movement, it can give a certain spaciousness or a wider view for that to move through a little bit more easily. So as I was sitting there in this royal chair, I was feeling this wide expanse that anything in that moment could have moved through me, but I was just this royal seat. So it was a kind of empowerment that stayed with me quite strongly after that. And it seems that when we, or as we begin to have a confidence in the depth of what we are, a confidence in that innate goodness, it also gives this empowerment for what is moving through us to move through with more ease. And that no one is going to take our seat for us. Like, we have to take our seat. We have to sit in the seat of our own life. And that confidence that can come to do that allows our practice to keep deepening and growing. So I often remember Pema Chodron, when she was saying, until we truly honour ourselves as the source of wisdom and compassion, not a great deal can happen. Until we sit there with that level of regard for our own interior, it's not going to really start speaking to us. So I had this poem. So this was called a Vajra song by a monk, and it was a spontaneous song that came to him when he was sitting high up in the mountains. And he said, please don't wander. Please don't wander too far. Keep a deep alertness in your being. Keep a deep alertness in your being, and do not be hoodwinked by the inner lies that may come to you. Please do not cling to likes and dislikes. Please do not cling to raising yourself up into the air or throwing yourself to the ground. Look into the nature of your essence. Look into the nature of your essence. Free from dualistic fixation. Realize your mind is unfabricated alpha purity. There is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There is nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. There is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There is nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. Non-meditation is spontaneous perfection, so capture the royal seat. So capture the royal seat. So there was another kind of empowerment that came in the Tibetan tradition in a more traditional form that I think sort of speaks to this the moment that I had on the rock when I realized I could sit in a much bigger seat. And it was when in some of the practices that women were starting to not be treated so well, that some of the practices were getting obscured, and that there was a sense that women couldn't reach enlightenment as quickly as men could. And there was a sense that a lot of the practices that were happening, which were a lot about the restraint, that, you know, in order to feel this depth of what I am, I will say no to all of these things, so I won't be hoodwinked by all of these things and think I need these things. And one of them was obviously women. So a lot of the practices that were happening, if desire was, if any of the monks felt desire, they would be told to deconstruct a woman's body and see that she's not, you know, really beautiful, but take out one piece of her hair and just look at that, or take out one tooth and is that beautiful? No way. And or peel off the skin and look at what's under the skin. And so it was a way for, you know, the monks to turn their gaze away from that. But very easily or very quickly, that could also instill a denigration of women that was still hidden in the culture and then was being reflected in these practices, which were meant to actually be much more deeper and penetrating than that. So around this kind of time, this female manifestation of a Buddha called Vajra Yogini was reintroduced into the canon. And she was very blood red, and she was always naked and she was always dancing, and incredibly open, and had so planted herself in this deep essence, so disidentified herself with all the habits of mind and rooted somewhere very trustable. And just one of the things that she spoke about that I wanted to speak of was this quality of divine pride. So this quality of loving and celebrating the depth of what we are, and sitting in the spirit of celebration of that. And so not so much this celebrating of this I that just so wants to feel strong or feel empowered, but just because naturally we're here and naturally there is this depth, and celebrating that quality. And she was saying particularly for women to start to feel this quality of divine pride, that yes, I actually can open as wide as the Buddha, and yes, I can see through habits of mind that are seriously distorting my experience, and yes, I can take that depth of awakening in that seat. So it was this very big empowerment that yes, we can. And because sometimes so quickly, like there's doubts, like, oh, could something really happen in my practice, or could I really come in contact that deep with experience? And we don't even know, but there can just be this foggy, I'm just practicing. But the sort of rigor and the passion that can come, that like us here, like every person for thousands and thousands of years that's been in a human body and practiced to cut through suffering and to put ourselves into that deep love with life, that it is deeply accessible to all of us. And when we can really feel that, it works as a kind of, again, an open palm to allow our practice to unfold. It's like the seat in which the, you know, flower can bloom from, this quality of divine pride. And very often, sometimes there can be a foggy sense of doubt in our practice, a kind of, and it feels like that's the truth. It feels like it's so in our personalities to think, maybe this can't happen, or, you know, just like a slightly doomsday feeling. I mean, I've worked with that. I called it doomsday. I had it on my 1 year in the shack. I was like, watch out, doomsday. When that energy was there, don't believe in it. You know, we believe so much in our habitual states of mind. They're like inside our skin. And sometimes we actually have picked up doubt and wrapped it around ourselves and then wonder why things aren't moving. And it just feels like that's just real. So I've learned a lot about the divine pride from working with people with different disabilities in the theatre company, and of this enjoyment in ourselves. And very often, when I remember when I first, so I'm just slightly tired. I can feel my mind's going a little bit slowly, but moving a little bit. So I'll just go a bit slow. But so I remember, I went to the first performance I saw with people with disabilities. Now I've been working for about 6 years. I remember sitting there and watching at the end of the show, they'd been doing all these performances, and we started clapping and going, yeah, and up on the stage, they were going, yeah, like totally responding to that clap. Like, it was like, oh, yeah, so good. And what it evoked was this, like, joy, rapture, like ecstasy in the room of them going, yeah, like, and it was all this, you know, yeah, yeah, and then us going, yeah. And that kind of unencumbered, wow, I was great in that moment. That wasn't this sticky, you know. It was just, yes, I did well. And yes, you were amazing. It aerated the whole room. It was like a 10-day retreat, the feeling. I was actually bawling. I was crying at, like, you know, people were singing to that Johnny Farnham song, you know, you're the voice, try and understand it. But people seeing this was so much like, you know, they had to work, like sunsets with and cerebral palsy, they had to work so hard just to get that one limb out to make that movement. Yeah, and then the people that I work with, there's a young woman, she wouldn't mind me saying her name, Erin, and whenever she has a good idea, and I say, wow, that was amazing, she's like, yeah, I know, where do they all come from? They're unstoppable, you know? I'm like, wow, yeah, they are, aren't they? And it's this, and you can sort of feel like sometimes when we're given compliments, I don't know if you know, and somehow I know in the past, like someone gives a compliment, like, yeah, not quite knowing what to do with that energy, like my face slightly going weird, like, thank you, you know. So it can just be an interesting, it can evoke something interesting. But to just go, wow, thank you, thank you, and to let that in, that we touch that depth of us in that exchange, and to be able to play in that enjoyment of what we are, that has a kind of magic that brings us into that goodness. In the talk a couple of days ago, I was making the joke about spiritual practices, like with all the magazines of people doing yoga and being in the perfect yoga clothes and all those beautiful bodies, and the wind coming in, the photos and the hair looking lovely, and thinking, and I said that made me feel a bit sick. And it was a joke, but then I just was thinking about, well, what is it that troubles me about that? I just went away and thought I can probably do a little bit better than just to put down. And I thought what it is that we really are going for freedom. Like, spiritual practice is really about freedom, and it's about digging underneath our, not putting a band-aid over our anxiety or a band-aid over our wounds, and just putting a pretty picture, but learning to be able to sit so deep in discomfort and penetrating so deep with that, that we come freer into this deep seat. So it's not like a fortification of self. It's not like, now that I practice yoga, my chest is so full of breath, I won't feel sad. Or now that my body is so looking so, you know, great, I'm gonna feel good about myself. I'm attractive. And all of these things are they're quick grips, you know, but are they really going to do it? Just at the end of the day, if we have a lovely body or not, like, we are all going to die. We are all vulnerable. But to be able to sit with our own pain and be kind with our own pain, to be able to sit in a wound and not, you know, metaphorically pick up a gun or throw a rock or collapse, but to just stay steady with that wound and let life go into that and love that and take us deeper. Like the yoga that can come from there. And I just think for us as humans to sit with pain and to stay open, that open stance that I was talking about, that's just right there with it, and trusting that there is a deeper view. There is. But so often somehow the fears are like, I shouldn't be feeling this much difficulty, I shouldn't be trembling this much, or I shouldn't be. But no, it's like, yes, 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 we're alive and we're quivering. And we're trembling and we feel and we respond, and we don't have practice to make ourselves immune. You know, we practice so we can connect more and feel more and respond more, but from this deeper view of what we really are, of what's trustable. So that's what I was coming to. And I was thinking about, I was feeling you in that moment and just how beautiful it is what you were saying yesterday. I just could feel, yes. I know, like, to have that courage to stay in those places and to not react and to stay there, and with deep faith and trust, what can begin to be purified in that, and where we can go into that non-band-aid place, then the freedom, because we're not unconsciously kicking out from those wounds. It's like the faith that can stay there and allow them to be fully touched and moved and washed. And fearlessly, and as we start to take that seat in life, it gives that fearlessness to allow these things to move inside of us. So I've been looking a little into using poetry as a means of devotion and as a means to explore that divine pride and that enjoyment. And there's something that is said that everything in the poems, all the words used, they're meant to all be expressions of this deeper essence. So, and the word is sometimes translated as adornments. Adornments of this deep essence and an expression of essence, like, you know, like the mango ripening off the tree that's totally come up from the sap and then out into the mango, that the words should be used to speak essence. And sometimes this is also translated into the way women dress as a devotional practice, that earrings are used to enhance beauty, to express light. Like a certain colour is put on to express that light and that freedom and that shameless, unselfconscious enjoyment of our form, that also enhances the energy in a room. Like when I watch some of my the people I work with in the theatre performing, and that celebration of self then created in me such joy. And then that, which is very different, you know, putting, say, like yoga clothes on, is again some sort of fortification, but to enjoy like dressing in a way that is adorning and connected to essence, and to that brings that out. So just somehow that felt connected. And in some traditions, I know in like Trungpa traditions, he liked people to dress, sometimes he would get people to dress really elegantly for a period in their practice. And the last retreat I did, it was a women's retreat at Matripa, and we would look out and see a man gardening in a suit, and it was just, he would always come out in his best suit to do the gardening. That was taking it to some level, I thought. But it was still that he was going against this shame of withdrawing to keep putting on that suit, to go out and garden, to remind him of his own dignity. And so the way that we have our houses, or the way that we set up our spaces for our practice, that we take that care in that simplicity. You know, and this is something I'm definitely learning, because I haven't necessarily always had care for those sorts of things, but to start to take real care into what we have around us can enhance essence not that moving from lack, if I have this, then I'll, this will cover up a sadness, but this freedom that goes, ah, I have the flower there and I put on some red and I sit here and I, that dignity and enjoying. So Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson, I think he speaks about this energy of empowerment, I feel in some of his words, and he says, my life is not an apology, but it's a life. It is for itself. It is not a spectacle. My life is not an apology, but a life. It is for itself. It's not a spectacle. He also says, absolve yourself to yourself and you shall have the suffrage of the world. So absolve yourself to yourself and you shall have the suffrage of the world. So I feel that some of the habits that can hold back this goodness from shining out and this shameless expression and this intimacy with ourselves is again that very quick habit of moving or abandoning ourselves or abandoning our experience. Often when we actually most need that kind hand, that steadiness. So how we can stay there and stay close to ourselves in those awkward moments, uncertain moments, angry moments, mean moments, and to be able to keep just a presence, a steadiness that almost refuses to budge. That just stays with that level of loyalty. And then slowly it works like a balm. And it's like the inner life almost reacts, but even if I'm like this, will you still love me? If I'm like, will kind of kick out and sort of flare out. And that staying that just says, no, I know your depth. I see your depth. There's something inside of us that depth actually wants visibility. It's like life wants to be seen in that intrinsic goodness. And so just that long enough, we just stay with that gentle hand, that willingness just to be present. There's a practice like this that it said like a little woodpecker bird on a wooden tree. And the bark is so rough and the bird's trying to get honey. It keeps pecking its beak against the trunk of the tree. And it just thinks nothing's happening, but it doesn't stop, it just keeps going. I'm just gonna stay steady. And then one day it just gets through and then there's honey starts to come out. And it just seems so dense, but it stays there and then the honey comes out and then the bird just gets drunk on the honey and just starts flying and then just falls down in this drunken enjoyment. But sometimes the exile that can be felt from that inner nectar, that goodness, can be very painful. Like when we're not in that connection. And so to keep just staying. Yeah, this too I'll be here for, this too I'll be here for, this too I'll be here for. And then in that staying, there's those moments where that connection, like that bird that gets the honey, can start to happen, can start to permeate, like those small homecomings. And I just had some other quotes from the writer Joan Didion, who was an older woman and confronted by some very deep sufferings and started to really think about what was important for her life. She was having a lot of 3 a.m. wake-ups and remembering all the things in the past that had happened to her and all the ways she'd wanted to get respect from outside. And she was beginning to have these amazing moments at like 3 a.m. in the morning when something was returning. And she wrote about these. And she says that these moments have nothing to do with status, nothing to do with success, nothing to do with what we've achieved necessarily, nothing to do with the face of things. But they concern themselves with a separate peace, a private reconciliation. And she goes on to say, she says, please let us free ourselves from the expectations of others and let us give ourselves back to ourselves. There lies the singular power. There lies the singular power of self-respect. I'm just finding where that went. There lies the singular power of self-respect. Without it, one eventually discovers the final turn of the screw and runs away to find oneself and finds no one at home. Do I need to say that again? Did that?
You could say it again.
Yes. Okay. Yes. So, to free ourselves from the expectations of others, to free ourselves from the image of how we think others perceive us, and to give us back to ourselves. There lies the singular power of self-respect. Without it, one eventually discovers the final turn of the screw. One runs away to find oneself and finds no one at home. So there is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There is nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. The same woman was asking herself in these 3 a.m. moments, and she's older now, she's about 75 years old, and she's at night saying, where did you lose your natural ecstasy? When did you lose that capacity just to wake up in the morning and, another day, what am I going to wear today? And have this form for one more day, I'm going to put on a red shirt, and then I'm going to go and get a cup of tea because I can drink, and then I'm going to... When did you lose that perspective of utter mystery? And it was a very sad story, like she'd lost, her husband had died and then her daughter died. And so she was, compelled into that deep questioning. When did you lose your natural ecstasy? She asked herself. And she was beginning to feel these moments of allowing that kind of sensitivity to her own moments in her life to return in this time of her life. It's very, very beautiful. And she actually went back to different times in her life when she was very scared and she sucked up and pulled away and mistrusted. So she was having these 3 a.m. moments of kind of re-unfolding her body in bed. And she speaks about, feeling that the wrinkles on her face and just resting her hand there and wriggling her toes and just letting herself come back into this flow of energy through her body. And so it's something in that taking the royal seat of actually allowing our limbs to open and to take more space, to allow life to flow through us. remember another man on one retreat, he said that whenever actually pleasure started flowing through his body, when goodness started flowing through his body, he noticed, oh, I must be doing something wrong. And he would start to pull his energy in again. And then just through conversations, we were saying, that's probably something that could, you know, be enjoyed spaciously. And then starting to come into just trusting this natural pleasure and allowing that to move through his system. And that almost was just his practice for the whole week, of just reacquainting with this goodness, this ease. And again, our minds are so tuned to when the difficulties can be there. As Jai was saying, they're so solid even if they're miserable, because they give us that sense of self. And that's very different from that, you know, I don't know, 75-year-old woman lying in bed feeling so light and just a hand on her face, and feeling the sweetness of that moment. And then she chose to really stay with that and keep exploring that. So how much, as much as we recognize, which is so important, when hindrances are there, when self-harassment's there, when comparing mind is there, when, you know, whatever is moving through us, that we notice that, but we also notice when there's ease, that we deeply notice when there's pleasure and get to know that texture. And it's sometimes, as we have this beautiful chance of being in this simplicity and not necessarily going to the usual quick ways that we might find pleasure or find enjoyment, but to start to find it in more subtle ways, in quieter ways. And it's again this reduction, that our practice isn't a reduction, it's to get so simple so we can start to taste things very quietly. I remember meeting one monk in America, and we had a conversation. He said to me, you know, you have no idea how much pleasure I get just from my breath. He said, I get so much pleasure from my breath. Just for him, this just the simpleness of breathing. He could just, for hours, just breathing. I was like, wow, that's great. And it's that same mind that sometimes when we do have a moment when there's like ease and it's like, oh, phew, finally, I don't want this to go away. Like, maybe now this is going to go. Like, I've just touched some depth and now, oh, it's just going to go. Yeah? And that's a very natural response. But even then in that response, we're not also enjoying that moment. In that preoccupation with that, you know, they say don't cling to pleasure. So that's the Buddha's term, you know, let's not cling to pleasure. And that's not just because Buddha's mean, you know. It's not because, and sometimes it's taken like that though, like it's a reducing of life. Don't cling to pleasure, because then we're in suffering again. Because it hurts. It actually hurts when, like, oh no, this is gonna go. And then we don't get to hold or behold exactly meeting that moment. And also in that moment, we're not trusting that deeper depth of life. And that willingness just to rest here and sit here in that receptivity that can allow pleasure to move through without gripping, but to really meet it even in more intimacy with non-expectation or non-manipulation is interesting to explore. And sometimes when the pleasure's there, it's almost we go, oh, let's make it bigger. There can also be that. I want to expand it. I want it to get stronger. I want it to keep going. And again, then we're not, it's like it always comes from this mistrust of life, like something as if it couldn't keep staying, or the gripping. There's that, I just recently I was listening to Nina Simone when she was singing with her band, and sometimes she would feel the musicians starting to want to make the music go up, like to get to the high. You know the feeling, it's like you think you should be happy and you try and rally, you know, it's like, yeah, get my, you know, and it's sort of tiring. There's something tiring, and then it's like in those moments, it's like we're not connected, we're not wearing the mangoes, it's just bouncing off the sap in the tree. It's like, it's more effortful. And Nina Simone, when she would start to hear her musicians doing this, she'd say, hey, stop. Like the music will go up naturally. You don't have to make it go up. It's like life naturally has that upsurge. In relaxation, in that deeper trusting, life will naturally do its thing. It's like we can't stop the trees from growing. We can't stop that next breath from coming in. And so can we trust life that much that we can relax that deeply and allow ourselves to be taken by these movements? So as we start to have experiences of being in the grip of something painful, of sitting here, maybe one day could have been quite difficult. You know, one of the days here on the retreat, there may have been an hour where there was a lot of struggle happening or pain happening inside. And then maybe 2 days later, it's like, oh, where did that go? Where? That was so intense in that moment, and then it's not here anymore. And then it gives pause. It thinks, oh, okay. So things truly do change. Things truly do move. And that gives that empowerment for the next time when there's something there, that perhaps we can meet it more openly or steadily or with more trust, that we can digest those moments of wisdom, if that's sort of making sense, that we use it. It's like, oh, that was there, now it's not. Probably this also has the same nature. And there's a sort of practical mind there that can come in that gives a steadiness. And as we keep planting in that royal seat, as we keep giving ourselves that self-respect or respect to the depth of life, as I began, that also gives more room for things to move. That our eyes are more on that wider view, that don't negate what's happening, but there's the windows open with our experience. That somewhere there's a window open. Like, this isn't all that's happening. This isn't all that's going on. And so I wanted to just share some of the traditional moments of these empowerments when we really notice something shifting. And I like how the Buddha speaks about hindrances, and when he speaks about what it feels like when they are leaving, when they're being purified for different states, and because they're very dramatic, so I think it's interesting. When he says that we come out of desire, and I would say when we've come out of, you know, from a place of lack, thinking that this object could satisfy us, yeah? I think we've all been in that grip with a lover or someone, and that you keep going there. You think, yeah, this, you keep that movement of going. You keep moving from the wound. Yeah, you keep going there, you keep going there, you keep going there, and you keep going there. And he says that when we actually, and this also, he speaks about the process of when we're coming out of these sort of hindrances, the process of disenchantment, where something that once enchanted us no longer enchants us anymore. And he says it's And it happens through being sensitivity to how it makes us feel. So it's like a difficult relationship that you keep returning to. Well, I know that I have done that, and you go back and it's like a kind of thorny branch, yeah? Or it could be a habit, whatever it is.
Addiction?
Addiction. So you go, oh, that doesn't feel good. 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 That does not feel good. That doesn't feel good. That really doesn't feel good. No, that doesn't feel good. Oh, that doesn't feel good. And then it's like the release. And then at first it feels strange because there's nothing to hold on to anymore, like it's uncomfortable. But again, in those moments, just staying in that openness, that the empowerment of not the grip. And he says those moments when we come out of that habit, it's like being relieved from a debt. As if we're being in debt. A big debt, and we're relieved from it. Or if we've been in a deep habit of aversion, of turning away from something, not liking something that's happening inside, habit of aversion. He says once we start to actually turn towards it with care, it's like recovering from an illness. Or if he says that when we're been really somehow in some moment sloth and torpor, and some of these I find a bit strange, the words, but sloth and torpor, when there's been a real heaviness in the being as a defense to feeling something, as that starts to aerate and starts to lift, it's like being released from prison. Or if we're in, some of us who may have more the tendency to worry, to something to come into the mind, the habitual groove of worrying about stuff. Worrying. So when we release from worrying and coming back to a more wider view or a saner place to approach whatever issue, he says it's like being liberated from slavery. Or he says when there's been doubt, a lot of doubt in the mind, and suddenly we start to see that it's not just, we don't take it for real anymore. We say, I've been doubting. That's what's happening when we recognize that. He says it's like crossing a dangerous river safely. So just to be able to notice when that a burden lifts from the shoulders, or there's a lightness, to feel that. Just coming to the close, but there's the story of Krishna in this moment of divine pride too, I would say. The young blue god, where he's eating the, he often goes into the pantry and he eats the butter from the pantry. And he just delights in it and just eats the butter. And he's just eating and just enjoying so much, and he gets caught eating the butter. And the story as I understand it, no one gets cross at him because he's in so much joy of just enjoying that butter that it actually delights everybody else in the room. So that unashamed enjoyment as an expression from the depth of what we are. And taking that seat to be able to receive that. of bringing that sensitivity to our practice of those moments of when it's opening. And as Jaya was speaking, I think yesterday in the talk, about how our mind gripping onto and identifying with habits of mind and holding them, even if they're miserable, but because they make us feel more solid, and having that courage to actually put our whole bodies behind these teachings. It's like we're sitting here, the dedication in this room to just stay here for 7 days. I mean, obviously there is a fierce dedication in the room, and just that empowerment to really go for it, to trust what we're doing here, and to trust our practice, can bring a dignity to our practice. That we really are here exploring as humans together in these very short lives that we have. And there's that, the poem, another poem saying that about Jesus, and I have Jesus in my room where I'm sleeping down there. He's a very lovely looking Jesus. Jara and I were remarking when we first saw him on the hall. And it says that Jesus was tender, luminous and demanding. He's tender, luminous and demanding as he always was. And his love 1,000 more times demanding than the killer sea. His love was more scary and more demanding than the killer sea. And that I just hope that our practice can keep empowering that fire. That set things right, that sets things clear, that sees through the obscurations and plants us in that place where we're connected and present. And in those moments where there isn't that connection, where there is some exile or it's not feeling so alive, that there's a patience, and that we don't put a full stop on that experience. But that the past wisdom can be there to foster and be there with that next moment. Is there any questions from that talk, or is anything being evoked?
What's the name of the talk again? I'm just trying to figure
out. Recognizing empowerments. Recognizing when wisdom's alive. And going, whoa. Giving that as much energy as when there's the sad or the
I keep thinking while you're talking, you know, that.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, a sun or up, you want to pronounce it,
yeah.
A seat to be sat in, but you know, going that next step further, you know, this retreat was like finding your own seat, you know.
Mm.
And I'm being comfortable.
Yeah.
Going that step. So that's what it's always meant, but it's gone a bit deeper for me.
Yeah, yeah. You become personal.
Yeah.
Yeah, beautiful.
Mm. And I feel like a texture.
Mm.
And something gives it more life.
Mm.
More able to. Like often it's hard to think about, you know, emotions, but when you give them textures, they become more alive, so you can identify it a bit more. And when I was reading, anything on emotions, it said, oh, I can't remember now, but you know how letting these, you know, emotions sort of drag you back into the past, can't remember how it's worded, but you know, you're living in all this and these unseen things just dragging you back too. Because I always think about, what did I ask yesterday? You know, self-sabotage, well, to me that's not making the same, you know, the same mistakes over and over again.
And grabbing that breath now.
Yeah, that's right.
Just because it's the habitual track, yeah.
You know, I theorise and I know it, I've done all this work, but I still can't.
Yeah.
Can't stop, but when you give something a texture.
Yeah, and to feel it.
Yeah.
It's like, it's when our heart actually goes, whoa, that actually really hurts, and then that's trustable, and then just naturally, of course, then we've got the empowerment to let go.
Mm.
Yeah.
And you, when you said like the aha moment again, because I was reading the little boards today, the aha moment, and it's not really about the talk, but it is because everything's connected.
Mm.
That when you're in your meditation and you feel yourself like drifting off, and then you notice, and then it's like an aha moment that it's okay, because deep down in there something tells you that that's okay anyway. Maybe that is the meditation.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if that's a little bit what you said.
Yes, no, that's exactly.
Yeah.
That's exactly.
Because I often notice that and go, oh, damn. You know,
yeah.
This feels good, but I'm not meditating, but I like it, and I'm going to stay with it anyway, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
No, that sounds like the right thing to be following.
Yeah.
But how quickly the cop in the head comes in, this is not meditating.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
As if there's another...
Yeah. Or like what you were saying before, you know, when you're feeling good, you know, with that, and I was feeling it when you were saying it, you know, you're feeling good, but there's this slight... holding on because you know it's not going to last.
Yeah.
But I hadn't really connected that until you said it, because you
know, yeah.
And often I get scared when I feel really good.
Yeah.
Because I don't know if it's just life, but when I'm feeling really, really good, I always know something's going to come and knock me off my perch, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But I suppose that's, you know, life.
Yeah.
But you know, having a bit of a phobia about it.
Yeah.
Not phobia. But yeah, you're noticing that you're clenching, sort of just this moment.
Mm. And then to keep just the intimacy with that moment of that good and trusting that, and then noticing the mind coming in with the fear, it's this might not, da 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 da. And then unhooking from that and then just coming back to stay.
That's right.
Because who knows if it's true.
Because you know,
who knows if maybe. You know, maybe the rug will be pulled under your feet, or maybe it won't.
That's right.
It might keep
going. It's
going
to be, it's just a matter of when.
Yeah, well, yeah, and maybe it won't. Or maybe it will.
Yeah, but to what degree?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I think it's great how, I don't know if it's planned that way, but all that stuff it is, everything's sort of sequential.
Mm.
Like even the little white boards and then the talks and... Probably feels like it for everyone, but it feels like every talk's being made for me.
Yeah, that's good.
Could you just run through those the hindrances, what the Buddha said about being released from the hindrances?
Yes.
Like?
Sure. Okay, so.
I just wanted to remember them, that's all.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I remember the one.
They're dramatic, aren't they? So desire, and I defined desire before in a way that I think is more accurate, when there's that movement from lack, thinking that this is going to do it for me or satisfy me. So when we're released from that It's like being relieved from a debt. When there's been a lot of ill will, either turned inward or outward or towards something, so a lot of that's self-harming or outer-harming. When we start to see that really clearly, that that's what's actually happening inside. And again, to identify somewhere deeper and to be able to look at that, ah. He says that's like recovering from an illness. Or when being instructed when we're in sloth and torpor, a cloudiness that's sort of covering over some deeper feeling. Like, you know, often there's confusion, sometimes there's grief. I've my experience when there's a lot of confusion, there's sometimes feeling under that. He says when we get to that, it's like being released from prison. Or worry and restlessness. It's like being liberated from slavery. The doubting, habitual doubting, is when we're released from that, it's like the feeling of crossing a dangerous desert safely.
Sitting in that throne by the river, it really reminded me of what one of my teachers used to say is, when you find your place, practice occurs, and that's really how it feels.
Yeah.
Your whole talk is actually is about that. Like when you really you know, find your sitting posture or your lying or whatever you're doing. And it's to do with that essence as well, when that's flowing, when you find that place.
No, thank you. That's exactly how I feel. And I feel like sometimes that is just, it naturally comes, and sometimes we kind of have to also, like, put ourselves there. Because sometimes the habit of not being there is so strong, it needs a little bit sometimes of a kind of, oh, hang on, I can actually do that. And that empowerment allows that practice to unfold as well, because then we're like aligning with the depth of life, not just our little concern.
Yeah, you have to put yourself, you know, you have to come and sit to find your place.
Yeah.
You have to come and lay down, lie down, you know, or else. You know, you have to go through the actions for that to actually happen.
Yeah. And the internal feeling of just valuing, as well as just coming and sitting or lying down, that's just the internal disposition of, even if you're on the toilet or you're just, or whatever, of the regard, like the wow, it's here that it all happens. That love is for you as well. What? Okay. Thank you, everybody, for listening.